dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We've done programs like this for about 11 and a half years, and I think there are few people, if any, who have understood better and done more, certainly in a non-kinetic way, to illuminate the nature of the war for the free world and the stakes for our country and our people if we lose it than our guest for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say. His name has become something of a household one. It's Dinesh D'Souza. He is an author, a best-selling New York Times number one best-selling author, no less, many times over. He is a filmmaker of considerable renown with, six or seven films to his credit so far. We're going to be dwelling on the most recent one, which is arguably his best. It's called Trump Card. It was released just before this election. We'll talk more with him, of course, about that election and what is now happening at the moment and what is likely to come of it. But before we do all of that, obviously I want to welcome Dinesh D'Souza, but also set the predicate for the election and its stakes. So we'll turn to that first, but let me just say, Dinesh, it is a distinct privilege to have an hour of your time and to welcome you back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's been too long, but we're appreciative that you did do a hit with us on Securing America, our TV program, last week, and we're anxious to talk with you in the course of this hour today. Thank you so much for the time. Well, let's start with what I would suggest is really central to Trump Card and to much of your other work, including United States of Socialism, a very, very important treatment of a very central threat to our country. Would you define socialism for us, Dinesh, and help us understand how it's distinguished, if at all, from things like democratic socialism or communism, for that matter?
Socialism, classically, or in its kind of original sense, referred to an economic transformation of society. It referred to society divided between two groups, loosely the rich and the poor. In Marx's terms, the capitalist class, which was seen as the exploiters, and the workers, who were seen as the exploited. And socialism envisioned a sort of overthrow of the capitalist class by the workers class. And then the workers would, in Marx's idea, seize the means of production and run the economic rudders of society themselves. So this was socialism in the original sense. Now, in the last century, the countries that became socialist typically kind of ignored this, because in no country in the world has there been an actual workers' revolt of the kind that Marx prophesied. And so socialism took on a little different shape. It became nationalization of industry. And in many countries, including my own, India, the government took over the banks, and the government took over the energy sector and the transportation sector. And so the government began to assume the steering wheel of the sort of commanding heights of the economy. And socialism was that. Now, in America today, the socialism envisioned by the left is neither the Marxian kind nor direct nationalization of industry. But what it has in common with all these forms of socialism is the notion of an expanded state, and is the notion of a central power in the government regulating, mandating, and controlling the general thrust of the economy. So there is an economic thrust even here. But there's also, adjoined to that, a cultural Marxism a desire to transform the mores and the morals of society that goes beyond the economic dimension. And I discuss both forms of socialism, or all forms of socialism, both in my book and in the movie called Trump Card.
You do indeed. And again, we'll talk more about some of the particulars of that here in a moment. But let me just stay with this characterization, because what fascinates me, and I find very troubling in how socialism is usually presented, is that Marx himself, I believe, saw it as kind of the entry-level drug to that ultimate workers' paradise, namely communism. And it always has this quality of the bait and switch to it, most especially democratic socialism, as something distinct from, you know, the kind that is imposed. Walk us through that, if you would, this evolution of one form of totalitarianism to another.
I think that for the left today, there needs to be some kind of distinguishing mark between the horrific forms of socialism that together killed something approaching 100 million people in the 20th century and produced a kind of trail of tears stretched from one end of the planet to the other. So the left tries to rescue the idea of socialism by saying we today are not in favor of authoritarian socialism a la Mao or even Fidel Castro. Rather, we support democratic socialism. And the idea here is that popular consent, a majority vote, gives moral sanction to the idea of socialism. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, all the leading American socialists have really stressed the adjective democratic and almost leaned on it heavily, because they know that they need to find a sort of a moral sanction somewhere, and they're relying on the idea of democracy. Now, interestingly enough, I grew up under democratic socialism. India was a democracy, has been a democracy since independence, 1947. So there's nothing new about democratic socialism. And in India, as in other countries, socialism produced this record of economic failure, misery. You know, India in my growing up years was the begging bowl of the world, and socialism was at least partly responsible for that.
You have a wonderful moment in the film when you talk about the idea that we can just perfect socialism by trying to make it a little less inhumane and a little better organized. That I think is just fabulous. Talk very quickly, if you would. We've only got about 45 seconds, about the idea that you can improve slavery in a similar way.
Well, socialism is the most discredited idea since slavery, and it was recognized by its leading scholars, from Hayek to Solzhenitsyn to George Orwell, to be a form of slavery. So imagine if someone today were to say, you know, slavery was kind of a good idea, but the implementation was poor. We're going to get it right this time. People would think that's nuts. And yet that is exactly what people say about socialism.
We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with more with the great Dinesh D'Souza. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with Dinesh D'Souza, author, filmmaker, public intellectual, and I think one of the great visionaries of our time. And it's always a delight to have a chance to chat with him, but most especially when we're able to showcase an important product of that vision, namely his new movie, Trump Card. I really hope you'll take a look at it. It's available online and extraordinarily well done. And one of the things that you do, Dinesh, in the film is you really dissect the appeal, if one can use that expression, of socialism, or the effort, at least, that the adherents to it are making to make it appealing. Let's talk a little bit about their attack on capitalism as a central justification for this more just, more equitable approach of socialism?
The interesting thing about it is that the left's attack on capitalism is entirely in moral terms. And that's important because the kind of classic libertarian defenses of capitalism, showing, for example, how efficient it is, how well it works, how it produces innovation, and so on, the left doesn't really deny that, nor do they intend to forego the cornucopia of wonders produced by capitalism. If you said to young people, hey, you know, you don't like capitalism, really? Okay, well, are you ready to give up your iPhone, stop using GPS, you know, not stay at an Airbnb, don't use Uber? Are you willing to kind of relinquish all these technological wonders produced in the free market by innovation and by capital? They would look at you as if you were nuts. They have no intention of giving any of that up. But at the same time, they're attracted by the idea, well, on top of that, how about if we get some free college? And how about if we get some health care, free retirement? So socialism appears to, in a sense, round out the picture and provide guarantees of safety that go beyond the accepted benefits of technological capitalism.
Guarantees of safety. This is, of course, the old social safety net, I guess, cast in a slightly different way. But that's something that we have a tradition of in this country, one could argue, going back to at least the New Deal and FDR. They seem to want to go considerably further, though. And as you describe in the film, they often point to the so-called Scandinavian model as the means of accomplishing this without the nasty side effects of socialism as it's been practiced worldwide elsewhere.
The left needs Scandinavian socialism because it appears to be the one type of socialism in the world that works, or at least works to a degree. But in reality, the Scandinavians are capitalist in wealth creation, even if socialist in wealth distribution. They don't kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. So Scandinavian countries, for instance, have corporate taxes in the 20% range, about the same as here. They don't have a minimum wage. You can hire and fire people for any reason. They have even less regulation than in America. With one exception, Norway, they have no wealth tax. None of the Scandinavian countries have an inheritance tax. So the bottom line of it is they try to create, through capitalism, a large pie. Now, they have a big welfare state, without a doubt, but they're very careful to distribute the burden of that across the whole society. So the pain is shared. There's no soaking the rich. They don't even demonize the rich. They impose taxes also on the middle class, and the so-called value-added tax, the VAT, a consumption tax of 25%, falls more heavily on the poor and the middle class than it does on the rich, because the poor and middle class proportionately spend more of their income on consumption. So you see, when you spell it out, that the Scandinavian model, even though it is invoked and pointed to, is not a model that anyone that I know of in America wants to follow or is actually following.
You know, it's very interesting. I'm not sure I would describe that oriented means of, you know, taxing people as socialism. It seems a more egalitarian model, to be sure, if regressive, in that it's going to hit the poor harder, relatively speaking, than the rich. But it's not socialism, as I think anybody would describe it, is it?
I think it's really based upon kind of the old notion of the Vikings. I mean, think about it. The Vikings would go raid another tribe, and then they would sort of share the booty or the kill among the members of the tribe. But all members of the tribe were expected to participate in the raid. Now, they might get the distribution to different degrees, but this is the Scandinavian model. It's kind of, obviously, it's not based upon raiding these days, but it's based upon distributing the booty across the society. But again, there's a very low opinion of people who don't play their part. And the Scandinavians have no hesitation about making the poor pay. So look at American socialism by contrast, which is all based upon demonizing the rich, sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul and the expectation of getting Paul's vote. You don't get those things in Scandinavian socialism.
Let me talk about something else that we're getting in the socialism of the United States at the moment, and that seems to be particularly using what some have called as a control mechanism in COVID-19. Dinesh D'Souza, you're seeing a kind of big state mechanism put into place at the expense of fundamental freedoms in this country, and you document this powerfully in Trump Card. Talk us through what this looks like and what it portends.
COVID has proven to be a real political opportunity for the left, and it's been fully exploited by Democratic governors at the state level. And now the left is not, for the first time, using what can be called the politics of fear. FDR discovered in the era of the Depression that he could, against this backdrop of public fear and stampede, that he could get things through. He could get policies adopted that would not otherwise be acceptable. And so the Democrats have recognized, and you can see that in other contexts, how they create this atmosphere of fear. In the 1970s, when I came to America, you know, the world is running out of food. In the 1980s, nuclear winter. In the 1990s, the ozone layer was dissipating. And for the last 20 years, climate change. And of course, now coronavirus. I think what makes this different is that the left has moved from economic policies to now trying to use fear to curtail civil liberties. That was not done before. Roosevelt, for example, didn't do that except, of course, the curtailment of liberties under World War II. But now we see the First Amendment being restricted, freedom of assembly, religious freedom, the right to worship. So basic civil liberties that are in the Bill of Rights that are actually not up for democratic referendum, yet even so, these governors have run roughshod over those rights, and it seems that it has put them in the habit of recognizing that they would actually like to control our civil liberties if they could.
You talk very powerfully in the film with Kelly Shackelford about the impact in particular on freedom of religion, our first freedom, under the First Amendment. This is not an accident, comrade, is it?
Not at all. I think it was the Soviet dissident Igor Shafarevich who said that socialism always goes after not merely property, but it also goes after the family and the church. Marx, for example, rails against the sort of traditional or patriarchal family. And Marx, of course, was a notorious atheist also. And Orwell, I think, makes the point that all forms of socialism, including democratic socialism, move inexorably in the direction of tyranny. And we see that it's no different in this case. The ultimate goal is to sort of regulate the whole society, to bring the citizen under the sort of paternal hand of the state. And religion gets in the way of that. And so the extent these days of going after religious freedom, I think, is remarkable. I mean, the Colorado Christian baker is kind of a good example. They want to force him to say something, to put a message, if you will, on the cake that he doesn't want to say. He's willing to sell a cake. He's willing to bake a cake. They can buy anything from his store. He's just not going to make that statement because it contradicts his conscience. And so the left here uses the sort of principle of anti-discrimination to say, okay, we're going to make him say it. And if he doesn't say it, we're going to ruin him. And if he goes to the Supreme Court and wins, we'll sue him again. And the point is not just to terrorize him, but to terrorize everyone into realizing not to be like him. So if they try to exercise their religious freedom in sort of contravention of these sort of ideological propositions of the left, they too will suffer the same fate.
Let me turn to one other piece of this that you've, I think, very helpfully illuminated, partly by your own experience, Dinesh, and that is the deep state aspects of what we find happening in America, a clear, well, preference, I'd say, for socialism, even in the Trump administration, not at the political level, certainly not at Donald Trump's level, but riddled throughout the agencies of government. Give us an example or two of that and how it is contributing to this fundamental transformation of America that Barack Obama promised in the eve of his election in 2008?
Well, Obama took the kind of external strategies of community organizing, if you will, of activism from the outside, and he brought them inside the government.
Community organizing.
Community organizing by the state. And that the impact of that is being felt even now, even during the Trump years. And so, for example, if one looks at the so-called deep state, the police agencies of government I'm referring to here, it's inconceivable to me that Strzok and Page and Clapper and Brennan and Comey, all of these guys went on independent expeditions to do surveillance, you know, entrap Flynn, try to overthrow the Trump presidency. No, someone directed them. This was a coordinated effort.
It's pretty clear that the President of the United States himself was read in on this, if not directing it as well. We'll talk more about that. And what else is in store for us if these guys have their way? With Dinesh D'Souza, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are continuing this extraordinarily timely conversation with one of the great thinkers about America, what it is, what it must still remain in the face of great challenges to our Constitution, to the Republic founded on it, and to the very freedoms that it all is guaranteeing. Dinesh, we've been talking a bit about elements of this socialist takeover of our country, some of it sort of sub rosa, some of it rather overt and public. We're going to talk more about how this plays into the possibility of a Biden-Harris administration in a moment. But first, I just wanted to ask you to finish a thought I've unfortunately forced to interrupt you in making about how the deep state has indeed been weaponized against, well, people like yourself, to say nothing of Mike Flynn or Donald Trump, for the purpose of essentially suppressing you and rendering you incapable of interfering with their grand design for this country, namely its fundamental transformation.
Well, this is a signature practice of socialist regimes to use the state to go after political dissidents and opponents. And this was true in the worst forms of socialism. It's true, for example, in Venezuela today, where the Chavistas do exactly this. In this case, yes, I think Obama was the ringleader. He was the choir director, if you will, of this type of music. I think, interestingly, also, if we go to the thugs on the street, kind of moving from thugs with badges to thugs on the street, a lot of this Antifa, BML, BLM agitation, the riots, the burning, that is also an Obama trademark. And Obama himself plays a very interesting role in this. Essentially, he sows the seeds of division. And then just when the fires are raging, he shows up as the firefighter. Oh, I see there's some trouble around here. I wonder if we can rise above the shouting and try to find some. So the idea here is to set the fuse and be the arsonist and then come as the firefighter and then become the moral authority in trying to resolve the dispute. So it's kind of a familiar move. We were taken by surprise when Obama first did this sort of stuff. Now it's become kind of his trademark. And I think we're on to it, but it's still rather distasteful to see.
And to your point, Dinesh, about people, you know, identifying and oppressing their political opponents, we have the phenomenon of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez now talking up, creating lists of people who were Trump supporters, with the clear implication being that there's going to be something bad happening to them should there be a new regime in the United States. Let me finally ask you quickly about the media. You do a very impressive job of exposing the role that they have been playing, and it leads us right into the upshot of the elections to this point for the presidency in 2020. Just quickly, how does the media as an instrument of the state play a role in the great socialist takedown of freedom and oppression of people in regimes around the world?
Well, the media has, in very chilling ways, become the cheerleader, if you will, for repression. I mean, who would have thought, those of us who sort of were had our youth in the era of the 60s when the left railed against the CIA and railed against the FBI, demanded congressional investigations of the sort of what goes on behind closed doors and in the shadows. And now the media has become the defender of the deep state. The coverage of the news is so transparently one-sided that the media puts its own credibility on the line. You can't really believe what you're seeing because it's so manifestly imbalanced. And these reporters are so obviously advocates. Now, we had that even in the past, but it was at least camouflage, and you could appeal to higher standards. You could say things like, look at the look at the way in which you've shredded the idea of objectivity and the way you've covered, for example, Mondale as opposed to Reagan. And the reporter then would say, oh, well, I was trying to do this. So there was at least an attempt to meet a standard of impartiality or objectivity. But I think what's striking today is that even that standard has gone out the window. And so I think public trust in this institution called media is surely at an all-time low.
It is indeed. And this is particularly evident, of course, in something that happened after, I think, your film was set to be released, namely the exposure of Hunter Biden's laptop and the degree to which virtually the entirety of the press refused to talk about that story at all, other than as an example of more Russian disinformation. It was so stunning, I think, to those of us who really understand what a terrible indictment it was of the Biden family and what a problem it represents, particularly for Joe Biden, should he be the commander-in-chief. Again, we'll talk about that more in a moment. But just one last thing before we take a break. I am so proud of the part of the film in which you drill down on a phenomenon that I personally have been very worried about, our Center for Security Policy has worked hard on for years, and that is what we've called the red-green axis. Would you talk a little bit about how it is that Sharia supremacists, as I think they're best described, can possibly collaborate with, let alone make common cause to the end of destroying our country, with the radical left, as you've documented in the film?
Yes, on the surface you have a mystery, because the Islamic radicals are the most illiberal people in the world. And the permissive policies of the left are anathema to them, particularly on issues like gay rights and so on. But they have a common enemy, and the common enemy is not just Trump, but it's also Christianity, it's conservative values. And so you have these strange bedfellows who come together in a common campaign, and they plan to sort out their differences later. But at this point, they each provide something to the other. So the left looks to the radical Muslims to organize the Muslim community and turn it into just another constituency. In other words, to deliver the votes that the left relies on in this attempt to kind of create a majority coalition of oppressed victim groups. And then from the Muslim side, what the left provides is political protection and cover and access to the media. And if anyone criticizes radical Islam, you, for example, then the left turns around and goes, you're an Islamophobe. So the left ultimately gives a certain kind of cover to the radical Muslims in exchange for the delivery of the Muslim vote.
And you make a very important case study in the film about Ilhan Omar and the role she is playing in this red-green axis, but also the people who are making possible her, well, I think of it as seditious activities. Talk a little bit about Qatar and Iran and Ilhan Omar, Dinesh.
Well, one of the powerful themes in the film is the way in which radical Muslim regimes, this is not about Muslims organizing in Dearborn, Michigan or something, it's about radical regimes like Iran using Qatar and other kind of front groups in order to funnel money into American politics to try to influence the outcome. So this is, you could call it Islamic collusion, and it's a bigger phenomenon than Russia collusion. Ilhan Omar enjoys a certain kind of weird protection from the media, which is, I think, partly the result of the fact that she claims to be a quadruple victim. She's sort of the ultimate expression of what, in both my book and movie, I call identity socialism, socialism married to identity politics. So she basically goes, I'm a woman and oppressed on that count. I'm a person of color. I am a Muslim who wears the hijab. I'm from the desert. So all of this gives Ilhan Omar, you may say, a claim to the bottom rung of the ladder, and the media rushes to her defense anytime some scandal comes out and tries its best to suppress it.
And in fairness, so does the Democratic leadership. I mean, she has been able to get protection, including from Nancy Pelosi. You may remember, Dinesh, I'm sure you do, and I think our audience probably does too, when there was going to be a resolution condemning her for her anti-Semitism, and lo and behold, it turned out to be a criticism of white supremacism, and Ilhan was essentially completely, you know, spared any criticism at all. These are the important elements of the socialist agenda with its various allies and outliers. You have, as I say, dissected them brilliantly in Trump Card, Dinesh, and we have to take a last break. When we come back, I want to talk with you about, so how has all of this played out in this election in 2020, and where do you think we're likely to go from here? That and much more with the director and driving force behind a marvelous new film, Trump Card, Dinesh D'Souza. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily important and, I think, very timely conversation with one of our great intellectual gurus. He is a man who has contributed mightily through various media to the public debate about our country, the forces arrayed against it, foreign and domestic, and what are the stakes should they prevail over us, which is a perfect send-up for the topic we must turn to now, which is, what happened, Dinesh, despite your valiant efforts with this film, that has resulted in, at the very least, a very problematic and protracted election outcome, at best, and at worst, an incipient administration involving people espousing socialism, like Joe Biden, and even worse, another expat from South Asia, Kamala Harris. So where does this leave us at the moment as you see it in the current sort of turmoil about the election returns?
While Biden in the closing days of the election emphatically insisted he was not a socialist, he even said, I defeated the socialists, the simple truth is that a Biden-Harris administration would move us toward the United States of socialism. If you think of the free market and freedom at one end of the spectrum and socialism and state control at the other end, there's no Democrat that is pulling in the free market direction. They're all pulling in the socialist direction. Harris being, of course, just more radical, quite clearly, than Biden. So I suspect that we're going to see a greater choke both on the economy and on our ordinary lives. Things like digital censorship, which are already bad, are likely to become worse. I mean, let's be honest, we're facing the greatest threat to free speech in this country through digital censorship than we have, I believe, in 100 years, and the greatest threat in peacetime. So it's troubling, I think, where we're headed. And I think the American people who voted for Biden and Harris are not entirely sure if they know what they've signed up for.
And that's not an accident, again, comrade, as the communists like to say. They have been, I think, deceived, many of them. But on the other hand, there are many of them that actually have drunk the Kool-Aid. And of particular concern to me, and among the other things you've done over your extraordinary career, Dinesh, is you've been in the education business at King's College. And you've seen firsthand what we have been indoctrinating our kids with in this anti-Americanism. Talk a little bit about how that has helped create an electorate that would be receptive to this sort of socialist claptrap.
Well, socialism has been cooked and promoted in academia, I would say, going back to the 1960s. So this has been occurring with some constant force for 50 years. And no doubt it's going to produce an impact. And the intolerance with which it is promoted has only gotten much, much worse. In other words, dissenting points of view are shut down, and inconvenient facts are not even brought up. Very few young people today, for example, have a sort of more than cursory understanding of why socialist regimes around the world collapsed, how they moved in the direction of tyranny, what they actually did to their people. This stuff is just really downplayed if it's mentioned at all in the textbooks. And so ultimately, you've just got this kind of rosy sense that socialism is nothing more than social justice. There was one young woman who was interviewed on a TV show, and she goes, "Oh, socialism, there are many types of socialism. You and I are talking right now. There you go, socialism." So you've got this kind of view that sees socialism as nothing more than a benign extension of the word social.
And to the extent that it has now translated into a potential victory for Joe Biden, we are also seeing the argument made that, well, the media can decide whether he's the president or not. Talk a little bit about how that has translated into yet another concentration of power in, you know, unfree and sort of institutions that are simply not accountable, as our Constitution essentially mandates.
Well, after telling us for 4 years about how the Russians, by buying Facebook ads and other nefarious devices, interfered in our election and, in fact, in a decisive way, supposedly in favor of Trump, the media now declares with the same kind of unanimous voice, "Oh no, there's simply no way in which American elections are even vulnerable to being manipulated in any way." But I think that under COVID again provides the opening here. In the past, there were reports about how absentee ballots, for example, were rife with fraud, people filling out ballots for other people and so on. But absentee ballots were a small proportion of the overall, and so people didn't really pay attention to this problem. But in an era where essentially tens of millions of ballots are just blasted out there for mail-in balloting, the potential for fraud now multiplies exponentially. And then when you add to that the systematic practice in all the kind of crucial and swing states of excluding or pushing away Republican observers so that the verification of these votes, the checking to make sure that they're real votes as opposed to fraudulent votes, when you put those two things together, you now have an absolute recipe for systematic and widespread fraud. The real question, of course, is can this be documented? Can this be shown to the satisfaction of a Supreme Court that I think will recognize the importance of this issue and how democracy itself hangs in the balance?
And there is another element of it which is just beginning to get the attention that it deserves, it seems to me, Dinesh, and that is the cyber elements, the degree to which our swing states, among others in this union, have been relying, for example, on foreign servers overseas, some of which have connections, if you can believe it, to George Soros, to do the tabulations for the vote counts. And there does seem to be not just glitches, as they said in Michigan, I believe, but a systemic manipulation of votes, all of which is going, as you say, to create an opportunity, if it is allowed to run its course, for Donald Trump to challenge these outcomes. And yet, Dinesh, just what do you make of the fact that we've had, as I said, the press coronating the Biden-Harris ticket as now the president-elect and vice president-elect, respectively, without the Electoral College having even been populated, let alone convened and acting?
Well, the good news is the Republicans this time are not buckling. They're not falling for it. They're not going, oh, yes, you're right. We just have to live with this. Because they recognize that it's not just this election, but every future election, the integrity of every future election that is at stake. I think when we look back, some of the eerie phenomena of the campaign now become explainable. Like, why was Biden so smug about really not campaigning? When he goes out for an event, you have seven people there, and you know, four of them are from the press. So this would be explainable if they said, hey, you know, we know we've got this fixed. Why was the left so determined to ask Amy Coney Barrett, will you recuse yourself from any cases involving election, settling the election? They were very eager that she give them that assurance. Why? Seemingly because they knew that they were up to some shenanigans.
To this larger point, though, when you see Joe Biden beginning to conduct himself as though he actually is the president-elect, I call him the president not yet, but, you know, contacting foreign leaders and setting up transitions and, you know, appointing, you know, panels to manage the COVID crisis and so on, it does seem as though, I hope you're right, Dinesh, about the Republicans standing up against all this. I fear that, as is often the case, Donald Trump is standing up against all this, but a good number of Republicans seem to be at best, you know, kind of silent, and at worst actually sort of throwing in with the idea that there's really nothing to see here, folks. Let's just move along to a new comity between old Joe Biden, the former senator, and Mitch McConnell, who will be the Republican leader in one capacity or another.
I think that the Republican base is pretty much united on this. And so there are Republicans, as we know, who have never been all that happy about Trump. And some of them are kind of nursing the idea that, wow, maybe a Biden administration isn't all that bad, and then we can make a roaring comeback in the midterms and so on. But I don't think that is where the heart of the Republican Party is at all. I think that Republicans firmly believe that Trump won, and they're determined to see it through.
Dinesh, we have to leave it at that. I'm sorry to say, so much more to talk about, and I hope that you will come back to us as this drama proceeds and give us more opportunities to drill down on your masterwork Trump card. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and for the great leadership that you've exhibited for years now. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.